Chapter 23. Read, Write, Execute. Read, Write, Execute. In computing, these are called permissions. Functionally speaking, they determine the extent of your authority within a computer or computer network, defining what exactly you can and cannot do. The right to read a file allows you to access its contents, while the right to write a file allows you to modify it. Execution, meanwhile, means that you have the ability to run a file or program to carry out the actions it was designed to do. Read, write, execute. This was my simple three-step plan. I wanted to burrow into the heart of the world's most secure network to find the truth, make a copy of it, and get it out into the world. And I had to do all this without getting caught, without being read, written, and executed myself. Almost everything you do on a computer, on any device, leaves a record. Nowhere is this more true than at the NSA. Each login and logout creates a log entry. Each permission I used left its own forensic trace. Every time I opened a file, every time I copied a file, that action was recorded. Every time I downloaded, moved, or deleted a file, that was recorded too. And security logs were updated to reflect the event. There were network flow records, public key infrastructure records. People even joked about cameras hidden in the bathrooms, in the bathroom stalls. The agency had a not inconsiderable number of counterintelligence programs spying on the people who were spying on people. And if even one caught me doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing, it wouldn't be a file that was getting deleted. Luckily, the strength of these systems was also their weakness. Their complexity meant that not even the people running them necessarily knew how they worked. Nobody actually understood where they overlapped and where their gaps were. Nobody, that is, except the system's administrators. After all, those sophisticated monitoring systems you're imagining, the ones with scary names like Midnight Rider, somebody's got to install them in the first place. The NSA may have paid for the network, but sysadmins like myself were the ones who really owned it. The read phase would involve dancing through the digital grid of tripwires laid across the routes connecting the NSA to every other intelligence agency, domestic and foreign. Among these was the NSA's UK partner, the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ, which was setting up dragnets like OpticNerve, a program that saved a snapshot every 5 minutes from the cameras of people video chatting on platforms like Yahoo Messenger, and Photon Torpedo, which grabbed the IP addresses of MSN Messenger users. By using Heartbeat to bring in the documents I wanted, I could turn bulk collection against those who'd turned it against the public, effectively Frankensteining the IC. The agency's security tools kept track of who read what, but it didn't matter. Anyone who bothered to check their logs was used to seeing Heartbeat by now. It would sound no alarms. It was the perfect cover. But while Heartbeat would work as a way of collecting the files, far too many files, it only brought them in to the server in Hawaii, a server that kept logs even I couldn't get around. I needed a way to work with the files, search them, and discard the irrelevant and uninteresting, along with those containing legitimate secrets that I wouldn't be giving to journalists. At this point, still in my read phase, the hazards were manifold, due mainly to the fact that the protocols I was up against were no longer geared to monitoring, but to prevention. If I ran my searches on the Heartbeat server, it would light a massive electronic sign blinking, "Arrest me." I thought about this for a while. I couldn't just copy the files directly from the Heartbeat server onto a personal storage device and waltz out of the tunnel without being caught. What I could do, though, was bring the files closer, directing them to an intermediate way station. I couldn't send them to one of our regular computers because by 2012, all of the tunnel had been upgraded to new thin client machines, small, helpless computers with crippled drives and CPUs that couldn't store or process data on their own, but did all of their storage and processing on the cloud. In a forgotten corner of the office, however, There was a pyramid of disused desktop computers, old, moldering legacy machines the agency had wiped clean and discarded. When I say old here, I mean young by the standards of anyone who doesn't live on a budget the size of the NSA's. They were Dell PCs from as recently as 2009 or 2010. Large, gray rectangles of comforting weight, which could store and process data on their own without being connected to the cloud. What I liked about them was that though they were still in the NSA system, they couldn't really be closely tracked as long as I kept them off the central networks. I could easily justify needing to use these stolid, reliable boxes by claiming that I was trying to make sure Heartbeat worked with older operating systems. After all, not everybody at every NSA site had one of the new thin clients just yet. And what if Dell wanted to implement a civilian version of Heartbeat? Or what if the CIA or FBI or some similarly backward organization wanted to use it? Under the guise of compatibility testing, I could transfer the files to these old computers where I could search, filter, and organize them as much as I wanted, as long as I was careful. I was carrying one of the big old hulks back to my desk when I passed one of the IT directors who stopped me and asked me what I needed it for. He'd been a major proponent of getting rid of them. "Stealing secrets," I answered, and we laughed. The read phase ended with the files I wanted, all neatly organized into folders, but they were still on a computer that wasn't mine, which was still in the tunnel underground. Enter, then, the write phase, which, for my purposes, meant the agonizingly slow, boring, but also cripplingly scary process of copying the files from the legacy Dells to something that I could spirit out of the building. The easiest and safest way to copy a file off any IC workstation is also the oldest, a camera. Smartphones, of course, are banned in NSA buildings, but workers accidentally bring them in all the time without anyone noticing. They leave them in their gym bags or in the pockets of their windbreakers. If they're caught with one in a random search, and they act goofily abashed instead of screaming panicked Mandarin into their wristwatch, they're often merely warned, especially if it's their first offense. But getting a smartphone loaded with NSA secrets out of the tunnel is a riskier gambit. Odds are that nobody would have noticed or cared if I walked out with a smartphone, and it might have been an adequate tool for a staffer trying to copy a single torture report. But I wasn't wild about the idea of taking thousands of pictures of my computer screen in the middle of a top-secret facility. Also, the phone would have had to be configured in such a way that even the world's foremost forensic experts could seize and search it without finding anything on it that they shouldn't. I'm going to refrain from publishing how exactly I went about my own writing, my own copying and encryption, so that the NSA will still be standing tomorrow. I will mention, however, what storage technology I used for the copied files. Forget thumb drives. They're too bulky for the relatively small amount they store. I went instead for SD cards. The acronym stands for Secure Digital. Actually, I went for the mini and micro SD cards. You'll recognize SD cards if you've ever used a digital camera or video camera, or needed more storage on a tablet. They're tiny little buggers, miracles of non-volatile flash storage, and at 20 by 21.5 millimeters for the mini, 15 by 11 millimeters for the micro, basically the size of your pinky fingernail, eminently concealable. You can fit one inside the pried-off square of a Rubik's Cube, then stick the square back on, and nobody will notice. In other attempts, I carried a card in my sock, or at my most paranoid, in my cheek, so I could swallow it if I had to. Eventually, as I gained confidence and certainty in my methods of encryption, I'd just keep a card at the bottom of my pocket. They hardly ever triggered metal detectors, and who wouldn't believe I'd simply forgotten something so small? The size of SD cards, however, has one downside. They're extremely slow to write. Copying times for massive volumes of data are always long, at least always longer than you want. But the duration tends to stretch even more when you're copying not to a speedy hard drive, but to a minuscule silicon wafer embedded in plastic. Also, I wasn't just copying. I was deduplicating, compressing, encrypting, none of which processes could be accomplished simultaneously with any other. I was using all the skills I'd ever acquired in my storage work, because that's what I was doing, essentially. I was storing the NSA's storage, making an off-site backup of the evidence of the IC's abuses. It could take 8 hours or more, entire shifts, to fill a card, and though I switched to working nights again, those hours were terrifying. There was the old computer chugging, monitor off, with all but one fluorescent ceiling panel dimmed to save energy in the after hours. And there I was, turning the monitor back on every once in a while to check the rate of progress and cringing. You know the feeling, the sheer hell of following the completion bar as it indicates 84% completed, 85% completed, 1 hour 58 minutes 53 seconds left, as it filled toward the sweet relief of 100%, all files copied, I'd be sweating, seeing shadows, and hearing footsteps around every corner. Execute. That was the final step. As each card filled, I had to run my getaway routine. I had to get that vital archive out of the building, past the bosses in military uniforms, down the stairs and out the empty hall, past the badge scans and armed guards, and man traps, those two-doored security zones in which the next door doesn't open until the previous door shuts and your badge scan is approved, and if it isn't, or if anything goes awry, the guards draw their weapons and the doors lock you in, and you say, well, isn't this embarrassing? This, per all the reports I'd been studying and all the nightmares I'd been having, was where they'd catch me. I was sure of it. Each time I left, I was petrified. I'd have to force myself not to think about the SD card. When you think about it, you act differently, suspiciously. One unexpected upshot of gaining a better understanding of NSA surveillance was that I'd also gained a better understanding of the dangers I faced. In other words, learning about the agency's systems had taught me how to not get caught by them. My guides in this regard were the indictments that the government had brought against former agents, mostly real bastards who, in IC jargon, had exfiltrated classified information for profit. I compiled and studied as many of these indictments as I could. The FBI, the agency that investigates all crime within the IC, took great pride in explaining exactly how they caught their suspects. And believe me, I didn't mind benefiting from their experience. It seemed that in almost every case, the FBI would wait to make its arrest until the suspect had finished their work and was about to go home. Sometimes they would let the suspect take the material out of an SCIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility, which is a type of building or room shielded against surveillance, and out into the public, where its very presence was a federal crime. I kept imagining a team of FBI agents lying in wait for me, there, out in the public light, just at the far end of the tunnel. I'd usually try to banter with the guards, and this was where my Rubik's Cube came in most handy. I was known to the guards and to everybody else at the tunnel as the Rubik's Cube guy, because I was always working the cube as I walked down the halls. I got so adept I could even solve it one-handed. It became my totem, my spirit toy, and a distraction device as much for myself as for my coworkers. Most of them thought it was an affectation or a nerdy conversation starter, and it was, but primarily, it relieved my anxiety. It calmed me. I bought a few cubes and handed them out. Anyone who took to it, I'd give them pointers. The more that people got used to them, the less they'd ever want a closer look at mine. I got along with the guards, or I told myself I did, mostly because I knew where their minds were. Elsewhere. I'd done something like their job before, back at Castle. I knew how mind-numbing it was to spend all night standing, feigning vigilance. Your feet hurt. After a while, all the rest of you hurts. And you can get so lonely that you'd talk to a wall. I aimed to be more entertaining than the wall, developing my own patter for each human obstacle. There was the one guard I talked to about insomnia and the difficulties of day sleeping. Remember, I was on nights, so this would have been around 2 a.m. Another guy, we discussed politics. He called Democrats demon rats, so I'd read Breitbart News in preparation for the conversation. What they all had in common was a reaction to my cube. it made them smile. Over the course of my employment at the tunnel, pretty much all the guards said some variation of, "Aw, man, I used to play with that when I was a kid." And then, invariably, "I tried to take the stickers off to solve it." Me too, buddy. Me too. It was only once I got home that I was able to relax, even just slightly. I was still worried about the house being wired. That was another one of those charming methods the FBI used against those it suspected of inadequate loyalty. I'd rebuff Lindsay's concern about my insomniac ways until she hated me and I hated myself. She'd go to bed, and I'd go to the couch, hiding with my laptop under a blanket like a child because cotton beats cameras. With the threat of immediate arrest out of the way, I could focus on transferring the files to a larger external storage device via my laptop. Only someone who didn't understand technology very well would think I'd keep them on the laptop forever, and locking them down under multiple layers of encryption algorithms using different implementations so that even if one failed, the others would keep them safe. I'd been careful not to leave any traces at my work, and I took care that my encryption left no traces of the documents at home. Still, I knew the documents could lead back to me once I'd sent them to the journalists and they'd been decrypted. Any investigator looking at which agency employees had accessed or could access all these materials would come up with a list with probably only a single name on it, mine. I could provide the journalists with fewer materials, of course, but then they wouldn't be able to most effectively do their work. Ultimately, I had to contend with the fact that even one briefing slide or PDF left me vulnerable, because all digital files contain metadata, invisible tags that can be used to identify their origins. I struggled with how to handle this metadata situation. I worried that if I didn't strip the identifying information from the documents, they might incriminate me the moment the journalists decrypted and opened them. But I also worried that by thoroughly stripping the metadata, I risked altering the files. If they were changed in any way, that could cast doubt on their authenticity. Which was more important, my personal safety or the public good? It might sound like an easy choice, but it took me quite a while to bite the bullet. I owned the risk, and I left the metadata intact. Part of what convinced me was my fear that even if I had stripped away the metadata I knew about, there could be other digital watermarks I wasn't aware of and couldn't scan for. Another part had to do with the difficulty of scrubbing single-user documents. A single-user document is a document marked with a user-specific code, so that if any publication's editorial staff decided to run it by the government would know its source. Sometimes the unique identifier was hidden in the date and timestamp coding. Sometimes it involved the pattern of micro dots in a graphic or logo. But it might also be embedded in something in some way I hadn't even thought of. This phenomenon should have discouraged me, but instead it emboldened me. The technological difficulty forced me for the first time to confront the prospect of discarding my lifetime practice of anonymity and coming forward to identify myself as the source. I could embrace my principles by signing my name to them and let myself be condemned. Altogether, the documents I selected fit on a single drive, which I left out in the open on my desk at home. I knew that the materials were just as secure now as they had ever been at the office. Actually, they were more secure, thanks to multiple levels and methods of encryption. That's the incomparable beauty of the cryptological art. A little bit of math can accomplish what all the guns and barbed wire can't. A little bit of math can keep a secret.